Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the generous support of Meyer Bramley Insurance, serving Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas. Meyer Bramley Insurance can be reached online at mbi.agency or via phone at 844-890-2626. Catholic Conversations, where we talk about faith, family, and finance.
We are back, Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio. I want to thank our next guest, Father Michael Driscoll, who is on the phone with us today. We're going to talk about his new book. He is the pastor up at St. Mary's in Utica, and he also works at the hospital in Ottawa, which is escaping me the name of that hospital at this right off the top of my head.
Yeah, St. Elizabeth.
St. Elizabeth.
St. Elizabeth of Hungary, yeah. Third Order Franciscan, yeah.
Well, Father Driscoll, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
So you are a diocesan priest in the Peoria Diocese, and you've
That's
been
correct.
A priest for how long?
It was 27 years in May, so 1992 I was ordained.
Awesome. And you have this is a newer book, right, that we were going to talk a little bit about today?
It's a few years old, yeah. But since it's got demons in the title, it's not unusual. I get a few calls around Halloween time to talk about it.
Yeah, I bet not.
I don't know if that was your motivation, but anyway.
You know what? I don't remember how it came up in conversation. We had another priest in. Father Baker was in talking to about a month ago, and he goes, you need to reach out to Father Driscoll.
He's a friend.
Yeah, great guy, and have a great conversation. So again, we thank you for being here with us.
So, and it is a good time of year to kind of clear the air on the whole topic. So,
yeah, I guess before we jump into the book, I have five kids, and I'm a convert, and so where does the church stand on the Halloween subject in general? And you know, what should we as parents maybe be mindful of or really watch out for as far as, you know, like you said, demons go?
Yeah, there are a number of topics like that come up. I remember asking an exorcist about yoga, and so it's always very important to carefully define what do you mean by yoga? Do you mean taking deep breaths and stretching? Oh, well, there's nothing wrong with that. You mean chanting the name of a false god? No, don't do that. So,
yeah.
And so we could say the same thing for Halloween. Okay, you mean that children are going to dress up as a ghost or something and get candy? Well, yeah, that's okay. You're going to start worshiping, whatever, pagan gods or getting involved in witchcraft? No, don't do that. So, and so it is important to define what it is we're talking about. And unfortunately, the people who are least likely maybe to listen to, you know, Christ and the church are the ones who maybe should. Maybe someone is going to get involved in, wow, Halloween, hey, I heard about some a witch's coven meeting, then maybe I'll do that. Okay, then that's bad. That aspect would be very bad. But if it's my understanding is the practice of kids going around dressing up, whatever, was actually, someone could correct me historically if I'm wrong, that in Ireland they were kind of poking fun at the old pagan belief, like, you know, children
right.
dressing up like a witch or a goblin or whatever, just poking fun at, oh, come on, this is silly beliefs. We don't believe that kind of thing.
Yeah, I had heard similar things to that as well. So give us a little background on the book. What's the title of it, and what was kind of the inspiration for you writing it?
Demons, Deliverance and Discernment. And it's a Catholic Answers book. And I've been a priest 27 years. A good half of that or more has been as a hospital chaplain. So I was in Peoria as chaplain at St. Francis Medical Center there. And at some point, I started taking some counseling classes at Bradley University and finished a master's degree there and went on for a PhD in counseling at a place called Regent University in Virginia Beach, which was some online, some out there. And that was very interesting because that's kind of non-denominational Christian. And so it was a neat experience. But in any case, at some point in there, talking to a priest who had done exorcisms, a priest in another state that I knew, and somewhere in the midst of those studies, I was asking, but what are you seeing? What are you seeing that makes you think a person is possessed? So when it came time to start a doctoral dissertation, I talked to one of the instructors who I wanted to be the my head of my dissertation committee, and he was a evangelical non-Catholic, and I said, here's an idea. I'd like to, you know, talk to some exorcists maybe and ask them how they're distinguishing between, you know, what makes them think someone's possessed by a demon versus a mental disorder. And his eyes got big and he said, I want to hear about that topic. So I went on to write the dissertation, and dissertations are generally long and dry and boring. So, but that's the way they're methodical. That's the way they're supposed to be. And from that, then I wrote the book, hopefully not as long, definitely not as long, hopefully not as dry and boring. So that's where the book came from. The book is a little heavier on the faith, as the other, the dissertation was heavier on psychology, but they both definitely include both of those topics.
So I'm curious, the term deliverance there in the title, we can get to the demons next, but deliverance ministry tends to be kind of a Protestant type of thing. You hear a lot in certain Protestant circles, deliverance ministries. How did that play into the research and the book?
Yeah, I think if I'm remembering correctly, that Todd D'Aguiloro, who edited it, a great guy over at Catholic Answers, he said that was what that aspect in particular was what they why they wanted that one the book. The teachings on the demons and stuff too, which I was trying to present church teaching on that. But the deliverance thing was kind of an apologetics, because saying, okay, what do Catholics believe about this? And, you know, priest says mass, he's got the Roman Missal on the altar, he's got the lectionary up there, a priest does a baptism or a wedding or a funeral, we've got liturgical books for all that. If a priest or a lay person is saying, oh, I'm doing a deliverance ministry, oh, there's no Catholic ritual book on that. So that doesn't mean it's a wrong thing. But again, it's careful to define it. Oh, what do you mean by that? Because there aren't an official, there's no official Catholic ritual on it. There's no official Catholic deliverance prayers, quote unquote. So if someone says a deliverance ministry, oh, and what do you mean? If they say, oh, well, we'll pray for healing, we pray for protection against the devil, and oh, well, those are good things. That's great. But if someone starts to make it sound more official, like, oh, we've got a very powerful prayer, we've got, well, what makes it that? So I'm just cautious of what does someone mean by deliverance. If you mean you're praying for, you know, healing, spiritual healing, protection from the devil, those are great things. I do those. But be careful to, before thinking, oh, there's something special, some special power to this particular prayer service, or something special about this particular prayer that someone's calling a deliverance prayer. If it's, you know, I mean, I can say, you know, I'm saying a prayer of thanksgiving. Well, that's good. If I start to say that mine is a particularly powerful prayer of thanksgiving, you say, whoa, well, what made it that? So I would look at it that way.
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah. Where does the church stand on demons and in the world and actual encounters with, you know, demons? I mean, we all have sin, obviously, and so sin, you know, controls our lives for the vast majority of people. We struggle with whatever our particular form of sin is. You know, where does that threshold cross between, you know, just your standard kind of everyday sins and then, you know, really having something to do with, you know, a demon?
Yeah, well, we can start maybe with temptation, and I think the catechism, I think, might not be as explicit as the catechism of the Council of Trent was explicit, but we know traditionally we've got what we call the temptations of the flesh, temptations of the world, temptations of the devil. So we don't want to attribute every temptation to the devil, maybe, or maybe not attribute every temptation exclusively to the devil. So, temptations of the flesh, a quaint old phrase, maybe wine, women, and song. You know, so gluttony, you know, intoxication on drugs or alcohol, sins of, you know, against purity. Those would be temptations of the flesh. Temptations of the world, basically fame and fortune. You know, I want to be popular. I want to be famous. I want to be wealthy or powerful. So those would be temptations of the world, things outside of the flesh. And then temptations of the devil. Actually, the devil might be involved in every one. He might be in the background making things worse, making the other temptations worse. You know, we kind of, the comical idea of a devil with a pitchfork. I actually love that as a symbolic, you know, as an illustration. He is jabbing us all the time, you know, with just wherever our weak points are, wherever our temptations are, you can be sure the devil is jabbing you there. So it's not a bad symbol, you know, the pitchfork.
Yeah, absolutely.
So those are three sources of temptation, and the devil is one out of three. He's certainly not the only one, but he certainly is there. And then if we want to go from there and say, well, what does the church say about if we want to call it the attacks of the devil or the activity of the devil against human beings, the catechism does talk about temptation, of course. So there's kind of one end of the scale, the most subtle, in my mind, the most dangerous. The devil didn't possess Adam and Eve, didn't possess Eve, tempted her. That's the most subtle, and therefore, in my mind, because it's subtle, it's dangerous, temptations of the devil to commit sins, especially mortal sins. So the catechism talks about that, and catechism also mentions demonic possession, which is the other extreme, the most rare and the most dramatic, we could say.
So this is like all your Hollywood movies would be depicting some type of a possession.
Right. And kind of funny how like the movie The Exorcist, which I don't recommend because there are, you know, a couple of very bad parts. But it's kind of interesting how they, I don't know if you want me to mention this now, three signs of demon possession.
Sure, go ahead.
That the rite of exorcism mentions. Pull it up here. The instructions, the rite of exorcism has instructions for the exorcist. And the fact, by the way, that we have a ritual book, you know, I was talking about ritual books of the church, they're also a source of doctrine. So the fact that the church has a ritual for exorcism tells us, oh, the church believes in demon possession and exorcism because we have a ritual book that talks about it. And one of the instructions here says that the exorcist should not believe too readily that a person is possessed by an evil spirit. But he ought to ascertain the signs by which a possessed person can be distinguished from one who is suffering from some illness, especially of a psychological nature. The Latin would have said is melancholia, melancholy, in other words, you know, an old word for psychological, you know, problems. By the way, the evangelical and the other non-Catholic instructors who looked at my dissertation were very impressed when, you know, wow, really, the church was saying that back in the early 1600s? Oh, yes, the church definitely was saying that back then. Oh, you know, insanity and mental health problems are not something new. So here are the three signs the church says the exorcist should look at. And basically, they're all saying something that goes outside the laws of nature for a human being. So the ability, number one, ability to speak with some facility in a strange tongue or understand it when spoken by another. So there's one. If someone is suspected of being possessed and I'm talking with them and I start reading the ritual and they start responding in Latin, that might be a sign of possession. I should first find out, well, did they take Latin in high school or something?
Sure. Did they live in Rome for a while?
Yeah. So you have to be careful, or whatever language it is. You know, if they start speaking, you know, whatever, well, do they know that language? So you'd have to be a little bit careful to know that for them it is a strange language. And by the way, exorcists all say this does not mean babbling. This doesn't mean just, you know, spouting whatever, you know, garbled stuff. No, it's speaking an actual language. And by the way, these three signs are all going to be a mockery of things that God does. The devil mocks. And so he can't create, you know, so he just mocks God. He can't be God, and so he's, I will be like God, so he mocks. So this obviously is a mockery of what God did at Pentecost, you know, speaking the praise of the apostles, speaking the glory of God, and in all the different languages of the people who are visiting Jerusalem. Well, the devil's going to mock that. He's going to curse God in some strange language. And I was talking about a movie. So in the Exorcist movie, they had that the possessed person was speaking, you know, mocking and blaspheming in Latin. So there's one sign. Sign number two, the faculty of divulging distant and hidden events. So, and one exorcist said this is, you know, often the most clear. Suppose this person suspected of being possessed starts telling me something about my past, and I've never met this person before. That's pretty clear. There's really not much more digging you have to do. This person should not know that. Again, a mockery of God speaking through his prophets or some of the saints, you know, God revealing to his prophets distant and hidden events. Hidden events meaning like that, something that this person should not know about my past. Distant might mean, suppose they said something was happening somewhere else, another place, and I found out later on that day, oh my gosh, that person was talking to me, telling me something that was happening somewhere else in the country or the world, and there's no way they could have known that. Well, the devil could know it. He's a spirit. So there's that one, and that happened in that movie, The Exorcist 2, so they followed that sign. And then the third sign, in my mind, this is the most difficult to be sure of. display of powers beyond a subject's age and natural condition. Basically, again, physical things outside the laws of nature. Famous movie scene, the girl spinning her head around. I've never heard of an exorcist saying that ever happened, but the point is taken. It was something physical outside the laws of nature. Typically a great display of strength or something like that, but have to be so careful. I've been hospital chaplain now since 2003, whatever that is, 16 years. I'm all throughout the hospital. If you talk to a doctor or nurse who's been, in an emergency room for a long time or on a mental health unit, as I have in my hospital, one of the most heartbreaking things is when you see someone intoxicated or drugs or alcohol or just, mentally ill to such a severe degree that at least for a time, they're not in the right mind at all. It's very surprising how much strength a person can show when they don't care about hurting themselves or someone else. I mean, it can take four big guys to hold down a person, two arms and two legs for a smaller woman, and it breaks your heart because the person is completely out of their mind and they don't care about hurting themselves or others. So that we don't want to look at that every time and say, look at that, they're possessed, look how strong. No, that can just be a sign of mental health or intoxication. At some point, you might go over the line there. A little bit disgusting, but one exorcist said that one of the signs that he convinced him of a person being possessed was that they were spitting a long distance at the monstrance on the altar, and he said that, as disgusting as that is, they shouldn't have been able to do what he saw them doing with that.
Yeah.
So at some point, so that's going to be some kind of a judgment call on that one, faculty of divulging hidden or distant events can be a clear one.
Yeah, so those are...
And the third one, by the way, again, mocking God, that would be, miracles, healing miracles of the saints, Jesus walking on water. That third sign can be a mockery of that, doing something physically impossible.
Wow, fascinating stuff. So the church's default position is that... most people, I would assume, have either some type of mental disorder or an addiction to, drugs or alcohol. That's the church's position is that is the default. Is that kind of accurate? And then we go from there. Or?
Sure. St. Thomas Aquinas would say on things you look for a natural explanation first, and then a supernatural. Or if we want to make it the flip side of miracles, up for canonization. We want to investigate it. We don't want to presume that if someone says, wow, I prayed for this and it happened, it's a miracle. Well, and there again, it'd be important to define miracle. It may have been God at work, certainly by the help of doctors and nurses. That's a great thing, and God works that way all the time. But that's not what we want to call a miracle in the canonization process. So we want to look at the natural explanations first. And so same thing on the opposite side when it's the devil. Want to look at the natural explanations first, and if it can be explained naturally, which is why, I'll read some of the literature and in psychology, and they'll say, well, clearly this possessed person is, what will they say, like dissociative identity disorder, used to be called multiple personalities. I've not seen, by the way, these signs of possession, but you wouldn't confuse that with multiple personalities. The multiple personalities, there may be one that's a very angry and even violent or whatever personality or identity or whatever. That's a whole other topic. That's a controversial diagnosis. But that's not going to have the person doing these kind of physically impossible things. So there's really no confusing it with that. Schizophrenia could be a little bit more confused. Not so much with these. But people with schizophrenia, it's not unusual, I would say, for them to be seeing demons or hearing demons or nightmares about demons. And, schizophrenia is a real mental health problem. But over time, unfortunately, met and talked to a number of people with those problems. Over time, I've come to think again about that devil with the pitchfork. I think the devil is involved a lot, not causing the schizophrenia, but making it worse, mocking the person who's not going to be inclined to believe anyway. So the devil, I think, makes their problems worse and maybe does appear to them or taunt them. I don't know that, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he's cruel.
Sure.
He's horrible. So, yeah, who better to torment on that in that way than someone who, you know, is a little bit out of touch with reality anyway, make it worse for them. That's the devil.
Yeah. It seems like that it probably is potentially more difficult from the church's perspective these days to discern, potentially to discern based on the signs that you gave there. The first two, especially, it seems like with people's access through the internet, you know, to be able to learn other languages, you know, potentially, or to be able to learn facts about, you know, somebody from the church who might be doing some type of investigation on them or something. It seems like historically, you know, if we go back a couple hundred years, people didn't have access to as much information that it might be more difficult today to try to discern some of those things than maybe it used to be.
I see what you mean. That's an interesting thought. The language thing, you definitely want to be careful. Is this a strange language for this person? So, you know, how do you find that out? Well, you know, first start by asking them, and usually it'd be someone with a friend or relative, and try and find that out. But the hidden events, yeah, I mean, if they were simply giving an address or phone number, I might think, well,
sure,
wait a minute, they might have looked that up. But if they're telling something more personal, but yeah, you're right, that there certainly is more information out there on all of us. Yeah, if I post, I didn't think about that. I am a Facebook,
especially with
account.
Yeah, I was going to say Facebook. With Facebook,
people might put everything up there. Yeah. And generally, I think people who are, I don't know how often it would happen that someone is trying to fool an exorcist. I've never done an exorcism. Two times I assisted, I don't think the people were possessed. A little bit complicated story of how they came to, you know, a priest doing an exorcism. The exorcist and I both thought, you know what, this person is not possessed. They probably thought they were. I don't think they were trying to fool anyone. So that's it too. For example, I read you the three signs a little bit later in the ritual. It talks about the person, which we all know from vampire movies, if there's a crucifix or holy water, a vampire will run away. But seriously, a possessed person will react negatively to holy things, whether the sign of the cross, the prayers, a saint's relic, holy water, crucifix. But because of, like you said, the internet, or just because of movies and everything, TV shows, a person who thinks they're possessed may very well react negatively to those things as well. So that alone isn't going to, necessary but not sufficient. Yes, a person who's possessed will react negatively just to those things, but so will a person who just thinks they're possessed.
Sure. Now, I know that there's possession and obsession, and there's a third one, right?
Well, I'm glad you bring that up. You know, I talked about temptation, which you can look up in the catechism. I talked about possession here, which you can look in the catechism, and we have a ritual for. There's something in between, but the church really doesn't define it. So we've got someone like St. John Vianney, who, you know, temptation didn't get anywhere with him, so the devil just kind of beat the heck out of him, you know. Physically, noises and just trash the room and things like that. Repeated accounts of outside of St. John Vianney, others reporting that. Sometimes that's called oppression. But you won't find that. So I'm careful to say, well, that's a word, a handy word maybe that you and I can use if we want to define it again, or an exorcist might use if he wants to define it. But we don't want to say, oh, well, such and such, that's a clear case of oppression. Well, the church doesn't define that. We just say there's something in between or other than temptation and possession. So oppression is sometimes used, and it's a handy word as long as we define it, as kind of an outward attack. So maybe something like that with John Vianney. Or here's an example. I never witnessed this, but someone I knew who had talking to me had lived in several different places, including this person had been in prison. And they said each place they lived since they were a child, and I can't remember what had happened to them then, that they felt like there was some person, spirit, they didn't know what to call it, that was with them, and would other people in the where they lived would say, what, you know, weird noises, weird things going on. So that could be an oppression, something from the outside. Obsession might be, that's another term that's used, obsession, again, not defined by the church, so it's just a handy term of a more interior thing. That would be like I was talking about with schizophrenia. that what are we going to call that when it's a step beyond temptation, where it seems like the devil really is, you know, working on someone interiorly, you know, talking to them or giving them nightmares or visions. We don't know exactly when that is. We don't define it as a church, but it seems to happen sometimes. So sometimes it's called obsession. So the oppression from the outside, obsession from the inside. But again, those are the way I'm defining them that I've heard some people define them. Handy words, but we want to be careful. And by the way, like here's a one too. I'm a hospital chaplain many years. There's only two different times, but two different young women, two different times, different places, whatever. I'm talking about their eating disorder with me. Anorexia nervosa. And it struck me on these two occasions how they said, it's that voice telling me, why don't you starve? Why don't you die? Look what you're doing to yourself. Look what you're doing to your family. Why don't you just starve to death? It was frightening to hear them describing that. So in my mind, yeah, that might well be a step above temptation. That might have been some kind of a obsession, the devil obsessing on them, temptation on steroids maybe.
Yeah, I think to your point too, though, I think we all have a kind of that inner voice that both tells us the right things to do, but then we also, at least for me, it seems like we have that inner voice that kind of, you know, to your point, tempts us and works on us. And, if we followed it all the time, we would definitely be, you know, led astray.
Yeah, and can the devil do that sometimes more severely? It seems likely, you know, that there's probably a spectrum. They can do it very severely, and if we want, we can maybe call that more severe one obsession. But it's just important to keep in mind that those are not official church terms, and there's no official church ritual. Again, back to that, there's no deliverance ritual. Oh, clear case of obsession, we'll do a ritual. No, we don't have clear cases of that, and we don't have a ritual for it. Now, we do have... the rite of exorcism should only be done by a priest who has been appointed by the bishop, or the bishop himself, of course, could do it. But, you know, when people ask, well, what are powerful deliverance prayers? And, you know, I first say, as I mentioned here, well, the church doesn't have a manual on that. Now, we do have the rite of exorcism, and even though we shouldn't, no one should be doing that outside of an appointed priest. However, that rite, large parts of it are reading psalms and gospel readings. Oh, well, anyone can do that to resist an attack of the devil. Read the psalms and the gospels. It does talk about using holy water, the sign of the cross, the crucifix. Oh, well, why don't we use those? They're straight from the rite of exorcism. It even says there... late, kind of toward the end of the ritual, it says, throughout, the exorcist should repeat over and over again the creed, the Our Father, and the Hail Mary. Oh, it sounds like the rosary, you know? So, yeah, pray the rosary. So we can, if someone wanted to say about deliverance prayers, I'd say, well, gosh, why don't we use the parts of the rite of exorcism that we can all use anytime we want? Those must be powerful if an exorcist is going to be using them.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard... before, and I don't know if this is true, that in order to become possessed by a demon, that you have to like invite the devil into your soul or whatever.
That's there is a difference of opinion on that, as there should be, because the young man that Jesus drove depending on the translation, even seems to say a child when that would throw him in. The father said he throws him into the fire and into the water. Seemed to be a child. And how did a child get possessed? Was the child before the age of reason, or can the child before the age of reason get possessed? Some exorcists would say yes, from a curse or a satanic ceremony. Some would say no. We just don't, as one priest said, we don't really have a roadmap to the other side. So we have some basic teachings, but that's a little bit of an unknown. I do like the way one priest put it. One exorcist said, you don't wake up one morning possessed. You build a relationship with the devil. So it's kind of like the opposite of being, in my mind, you don't wake up one morning a saint. You build a relationship with Jesus Christ. So maybe the opposite of being possessed. But there seem to maybe be some exceptions to that. So a little bit open question there. Certainly, overwhelmingly, people who are possessed, if those do exist, they would be the exceptions. And even there, they might involve someone else doing something satanic. But we don't want to give too much power to Someone was worried they had heard that a Satanist or a witch can walk around. If they happen to touch you, like in a crowd, they can curse you. I was like, saying, oh my gosh, really? Well, then they'd walk around cursing everyone and cursing every house. So we're going to burn down the town in order to, you know, drive it. No, so we don't worry about that. You know, say our prayers, use holy, you know, have holy water and a crucifix in the house, go to Mass and confession, and then don't worry about the rest. So the devil, that's not going to end his attacks. He's still going to tempt us and maybe even a little bit worse, but just do what we're supposed to. I should, before, I know we've got just a few minutes, but if you want me to mention one more thing from, there's an added part of the rite of exorcism added by Pope Leo XIII in the late 1800s. Sometimes we call that one an infestation. It doesn't really have an official title, but it is an official part of the ritual, and that's for a demon in some way being attached to a place. So it's a shorter ritual, and it's driving the devil away from a place. I hate to say this, but a haunted house. In other words, some of those are probably, most of them, I think, vast majority, I've never seen anything that I thought couldn't be explained naturally. Sure. But there are enough reports that probably there are sometimes when the devil, for whatever reason, and that's mysterious, gets attached to a place and stirs up trouble there. We don't believe it's a ghost. We don't believe it's the person who died there and now hanging out for a while. No, they faced Jesus Christ for their judgment when they died. But the devil might mess with the place, especially if you're going to have ghost hunters going around, you know, trying to get people interested in that rather than interested in Jesus Christ and the faith, you know. So the devil might mess with people that way. But yeah, there is a ritual. There's some attack of the devil on an attachment to a place. We even see that briefly mentioned when Jesus drove the legion of demons out of the Gerasene, the man possessed in Gerasene. It says the demons pleaded for him not to drive them from that region, from that area. Like, well, that's strange. So why did they like that area? Who knows? You know, we don't know why. Maybe something bad happened there, and the devil likes bad places where bad things happen. Probably a mockery again. We have sacred places. Why shouldn't the devil attach and make a place, you know, kind of a place that he tries to make his domain? So,
yeah, I've seen again in countless Hollywood depictions of exorcisms and possession that the exorcist always tries to get the demon to name himself. Is that does that really happen?
Yeah, the ritual specifically says that the exorcist should not ask too many questions. As one exorcist said, you don't get in a conversation with the devil. What a great line.
Yeah.
Here's the way the ritual says. The exorcist must not digress into senseless prattle nor ask superfluous questions. But then it goes on to say, necessary questions are, for example, the number and name of the spirits inhabiting the person, the time they entered into him, the cause thereof. So, he can ask a few questions like that, but he shouldn't just go start asking superfluous questions. Yeah, again, most of the time, and, you know, these things generally aren't, you can't generalize. Jesus seemed to drive some of them out just by, you know, out with you, and they would go. But that Gerasene one, a little bit strange, and that's the only one we see him asking, what is your name? And even there, that's a mystery to me, because my name is Legion. There's so many of us. Was that the name of one demon, the leader of the pack, a group name for all of them? Don't know. But certainly the ritual does say, and as I mentioned, church rituals are sources of doctrine. So, yeah, the number and name of the spirits. So they must have names. And that's so mysterious in my mind, almost funny. I mean, when they're not dealing with possessing people, do they call each other Ralph and Joe and things like that? I mean, I don't know. I'm sure it's much deeper than that. But certainly he can demand that, and certainly some exorcists say that's very important. One exorcist said, well, yeah, I do that, but I'm not sure how important. So wide range. As a friend of mine said, we don't have a roadmap to the other side.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you, there's a new show out this season called Evil. I think it's on NBC or Fox or one of those. I don't know. Have you seen that by chance? Do you watch much TV?
Not too much. Ironic, I do when I watch some things like on Amazon or whatever. I do like the kind of the spooky shows, not the ones that are trying to be documentaries.
Right.
I like the goofy ones. There's one, Supernatural, and makes me laugh every time. They'll often be fighting ghosts, and they have a shotgun full of salt. And man, if you're a ghost, you get shot by a shotgun full of salt, you disappear immediately. I breaks it, makes me laugh every time. So You know, I like Irish folk tales, and they'll put a leprechaun in the same story with a priest and things like that. If you're reading that for humor and for fiction and to get a scare when something jumps out, hey, you know, go for it. Nothing wrong with that. If you're looking for those as a source of doctrine, you might
reconsider.
And if they're too gory, that's not good. And if they're mocking the Lord and things like that, you don't want. But like I said, I don't know, if Irish folk tales, they'll have fairies and leprechauns doing things, and a priest might come along and they might run away. I don't see the danger in that.
Yeah, on this one in particular, I've only seen a couple, and you know, it's basically a group of these folks that are employed by, the Catholic Church, and they go out and investigate, and one of them is like a techie guy, and the lady is like a psychiatrist, you know, and so they're both trying to find all the natural causes, and then the third guy is, you know, basically a seminarian, he's the only one out of the three that even believes in the Catholic Church. And so, Mike, I was just curious, do you know, do dioceses kind of have groups that do these types of investigations? If somebody comes forward and says, hey, I think I'm possessed, or I think my child or spouse is possessed, does that type of investigation go on?
I'm not sure about the techie part. That part in my mind is not helpful for people to think they're going to... I don't know, find something, something in the spirit world by electronic disturbance. Well, the demons just started did they just start causing electronic disturbances in the last few hundred years since we've learned about electricity? Or were they doing it all along and we just discovered it? I mean, it just gets a little bit weird in my mind. I'm like, I'm not sure about that part. Now, certainly, a person who's suspected of being possessed, if at all possible, the exorcist is supposed to, and that's in the instructions of Relic 2, in the instructions of the ritual. It would be good to have a physician, a psychiatrist, psychologist, you know, a couple people, talk to them, see, get their take on it. So that part is certainly a good idea, and I think most bishops want an exorcist to have that first, so that we're following the ritual, which says don't be too quick to assume. I kind of have an advantage that I've got a background now in counseling, although one exorcist said, well, if you're ever, you know, called on that, he said, you should probably get a different opinion rather than you being two roles. So I've never been in that role of the exorcist, but I have been called in, you know, what do you take, what's your health on this? Because I've got a degree in mental health. That part is good. I'm not sure the techie thing is going to be much help.
Yeah, I think he always tries to prove, you know, like through a scientific way, like, oh, this person thinks they're hearing voices, but really it's like, you know, the whirl of their dishwasher,
of
them.
Oh,
so
he
uses science, I guess, more so to try to
the
prove
opposite of what I said. Not going around with an electronic
he's trying to find concrete reasons for stuff.
I presume this is not a documentary or show.
No, it's just
fictional.
Yeah, it's like a Law and Order or CSI.
I don't know any bishop that would appoint a seminarian to go investigating that kind of thing.
Right, yeah. He has his own issues, too, it seems like. The couple episodes I've seen, there's a inner turmoil with him in trying to figure out his faith, it seems like. So, I don't know. It's a new show.
That seems to be a common theme in some of those type of shows.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not sure how they want to portray the Catholic Church in most of those shows at this point, I think.
Yeah, I'm looking here, the ritual, I think, somewhere it's the first number one of the instructions says, it's kind of talking to the bishop here about who to appoint for exorcist. He ought to be of mature years. So you don't want to, you probably wouldn't want to.
That would fit Anthony Hopkins when he played in The Rite, right? I mean, he was a...
Yeah, and when you said they don't know how to portray the church, oh gosh, what do you call those, a meme? I've still got it here somewhere. It's so funny. I think one of my siblings sent it to me, a picture of Anthony Hopkins from that movie, you know, with that look on his face and holding a crucifix, and across the top it says, "We all make fun of Catholics until we need an exorcism."
Yeah, I think I have seen that one. That is a good one. That was a creepy movie. I have seen that one. That was
If anyone wants to see a movie, that's not over. I don't think there were any really inappropriate or disgusting parts, you know. But that exorcism of Emily Rose probably came out 15 years ago. That was, from what I read, a couple books on the true case. Of course, the movie made changes and a couple things there inaccurate. But overall, that was a pretty good depiction, I think. That exorcism of Emily Rose.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I'm not being paid by those producers.
Yeah, I don't remember if I've seen that one or not, but I think, isn't there like audio recordings of that? That kind of freaks me out. I feel like that's where I would draw the line. I wouldn't listen to those. I feel like that's
There are. I found that on YouTube, which makes me wonder how authentic those are.
Yeah.
But there were a book. I think she was a sociologist, and then she's portrayed in the movie as I can't remember what. But she seemed to write a pretty authentic book. Sociologists are neat ones to learn about. I quoted some of those in my dissertation. When it comes to spirit possession in all different cultures, the psychologists are always trying to, I should never say always on these things, psychologists often try and look at whatever culture and whatever spirit thing is going on and then try and say, okay, how does that fit in with our idea of psychology? Well, our ideas of psychology aren't the be-all and end-all of modern American thing, are often, you know, many of them mistaken. The sociologists are more interested in what are these people saying and believing. I like getting that take on it. Naturally, I'm going to say, and how does that fit in with what we believe, the Catholic faith? But it's interesting to see what, from there, sociologists are often just trying to say, what are these people say that they're seeing and experiencing? And that's, I think that's a sociologist who wrote about that case, which happened in Germany. The movie moved it to the setting to America.
Father Michael Driscoll has been with us. Father, I so appreciate your time with us. It's a fascinating conversation. I guess to sum it up, don't do Ouija boards, don't do yoga, do prayers, do holy water.
Yeah.
Stay on the right side of things.
Right. Yoga, I'm careful to say, as the exorcist said, well, what do you mean? Are you stretching and breathing deeply? Well, go ahead. You're chanting the name of a false god, or like someone I knew went to a Park District class and the person started talking spirituality. No, don't do that. You know, so here, I'll end it with this. Jason, what exorcist said, this isn't rocket science. Prayer, sacraments, and sacramentals, do what your Catholic mother told you. If you didn't have a Catholic mother, do what your mother, the church, tells you.
Boom. You couldn't sum it up any better than that.
I know.
What, for folks that are interested and want to get a copy of the book, what's the easiest place? Is it on Amazon? As with all
Amazon
things, it seems like.
Catholic, yeah, or Catholic Answers website will have it also.
Awesome. Well, Father Driscoll, I so appreciate you coming on with us.
Oh, thanks. I look forward to talking to you again, Jay.
Absolutely. You're listening to Catholic Conversations on Catholic Spirit Radio.
You've been listening to Catholic Conversations with Jason Bramley on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 and 92.5. Brought to you by the generous support of Meyer Bramley Insurance, serving Illinois, Missouri, and Kansas. Meyer Bramley Insurance can be reached online at mbi.agency or via phone at 844-890-2626. Catholic Conversations, where we talk about faith, family, and finance. Download our podcasts at CatholicSpiritRadio.com.